I worried constantly about our economy and the general welfare of the nation, I was also concerned over the toll all the pressure was taking on the president. During our daily senior staff meetings with him in the Oval Office, I would usually sit on the end of the couch closest to his chair so I could watch him closely. I was searching for a sign in his expression or voice that would let me know if he was really as calm as he appeared. I was so preoccupied with trying to read him that I forgot how well he reads me. One day, mid-sentence, he stopped talking, looked at me, and said in a whisper I hoped only I would hear, "What?" Startled to have him pause in front of my colleagues, I mumbled quietly, "I'm trying to figure out if you're okay." "Stop staring," he said softly. "I'm fine." I was embarrassed in the moment, but later I appreciated that he was trying to keep his game face on, and our friendship and my concern were getting in the way. I kept worrying, but from then on I tried not to stare, at least when he could see me. Reflecting back now, I believe our friendship was strengthened by my time as President Obama's senior advisor through sharing so many extraordinary experiences during his moment in the history of our nation. And I was also a better senior advisor because of our friendship. I had a keen appreciation for what inspired and motivated him, his true north. Whenever he seemed distracted, he knew that I knew what was likely weighing on his mind. We all dealt with the pressure of being in the White House in different ways. In general, President Obama was very disciplined about his diet, and he was also a creature of habit, perhaps because he had had a slightly chubby period in his youth, or maybe because he just didn't care about food very much. An exception were the delicious pies created by the White House pastry chef. On the campaign trail, he almost always ate the exact same meals: salmon, broccoli, and brown rice, or chopped salad with chicken. He made an exception when we visited local restaurants with specialties. Then he would indulge to show appreciation to his host. He continued to eat his same usual meals for lunch well into his time in the White House, despite the fact that Michelle told him, "You know, you can have a different menu." One day in the first term, while I was traveling with the president, he looked at his salad and said, "This makes me sad." Finally, there was a huge sigh of relief from the other staff present and me because we ate whatever he ate. From then on, luckily, he decided to change up the menu a bit, but not much. The president's pragmatic handling of the Gates affair worked, and thanks to his steadfast focus on the long game, we were able to bring the nation's attention back to health care. Unfortunately, just as we began to tell our story, the Republican opposition was waiting with one of their own, only theirs was based in fiction. Following the president's press conference in July, just before recess, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi introduced H.R. 3962, the legislation that was, at that point, known as the Affordable Health Care for America Act. In response, at town halls they held over the summer throughout the country, Republicans started floating the idea that the bill called for death panels. They made up the diabolical phrase just to scare people into thinking the government was going to convene committees to decide who received medical care and who didn't. And it was effective. Stoking fear to gain leverage is an age-old tactic. Nobody knew what a death panel was. They just knew that they didn't want one. Confused people responded to polls with comments such as, "Keep the government out of my Medicare." But of course, Medicare is the government, and what we were trying to do was expand coverage. Republicans weren't just spinning words. They were also using every possible legislative maneuver to try to stop the bill in its tracks. We were all so frustrated that Republicans weren't remotely interested in a plan to deliver affordable health care to millions of people, many who had never had it before. But what was even more stunning was that they would choose instead to distort the proposal's benefits for blatant political purposes. My experience in local government in Chicago was that although there was plenty of political theater, most of the elected officials on all sides would eventually try to do the right thing for their constituents, and they'd fight over who received the credit for it. This was different. I knew from the University of Chicago that we could not only achieve better medical outcomes, but but also save a lot of money in the long term by ending the epidemic of the emergency room as a replacement for primary care. But you didn't need to be chairman of a medical board, only human, to recognize the scope of the benefit our law would provide. I couldn't imagine how members of Congress calling the Affordable Care Act a threat to America's freedom explain to their own constituents why they should be uninsurable because of a pre-existing condition. Healthcare should never have been a partisan issue, but I was very naive as to the lengths to which the Republicans were willing to go in trying to make President Obama a one-term president, in the words of Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Using healthcare as a weapon and being willing to deny it to people to win a political victory was unconscionable. And, as we would soon learn, they were very good at it. While the disastrous town halls in the summer recess were taking place, the president and his senior advisors regrouped one morning in the Oval Office to assess the damage from the GOP scare tactics. We all felt beat up by the death panel's ploy, and President Obama asked each of us to weigh in on next steps. Every day spent trying to pass health care was delaying the rest of our legislative agenda from moving forward, including comprehensive immigration reform and clean energy. Phil Schillera, head of the White House Legislative Affairs Department, was the first. Phil was an unusual combination of optimism and creativity, with a healthy dose of the reality that with Congress, you must expect the worst. Phil knew better than almost anyone else that our goal was a long shot given the strong opposition in Congress. But his mantra was always, if one way doesn't work, try a second. If they both don't work, there must be a third way, and that will work. Because of that, the president nicknamed him Third Way Phil. What say you, Third Way Phil? President Obama began. Phil made a strong case for a narrow path forward. Then the president asked the rest of his senior team for their views. Some cautioned that we should cut our losses and just protect children. Others said that even that was a long shot. My view was that we should go big or go home. Nancy Ann agreed. After hearing everyone out, the president returned to Phil, who said, "Well, Mr. President, if you're feeling lucky, there may still be a third way." Some of the advisors looked down. Others just shook their heads in disbelief. Third Way Phil was resting the success of his third way on luck? President Obama nodded to himself, stood up from his chair, and leaving us sitting on the couches by the fireplace, walked over to the Resolute desk, a gift from Queen Victoria to President Hayes, and used by many of Hayes's successors. With his back to us, he looked out of the windows facing the south lawn and asked, "Phil, where are we?" Phil looked around at all the other advisors, hoping one of us might know what the president was talking about, but we shrugged. "We're in the Oval Office," he said tentatively. "Yes, and what's my name?" the president asked. "President Obama." "No, Phil, it's President Barack Hussein Obama. And we're in the Oval Office, and you're asking me if I'm lucky? Of course I'm lucky. Now everyone, back to work and figure out how to accomplish the third way." After working on this issue nonstop for months, we were all totally beaten down. But in that moment, the president pierced the heavy mood in the room, and we all started laughing, even Phil. In reminding us how he had already beat the long odds just to be there, this was no time to quit trying, for the impossible is only impossible until we make it become inevitable. We were making slow progress even with the Democratic majorities because Senator Max Baucus, who was chairman of the committee responsible for the bill, wielded much power, and he was determined to try to strike a deal with Senator Chuck Grassley, his longtime Republican colleague, who was the ranking member of the committee. Then tragedy struck. On August 25th, when the Obamas, Pete Rouse, and I were all on Martha's Vineyard for vacation, Senator Ted Kennedy died of a brain tumor. His death was a huge blow to both the president and the first lady, who'd become close friends with him and his wife, Vicky. Pete had worked with Kennedy for decades and he flew with us on Marine One to the funeral, sharing stories of their adventures together. But the tragedy of the senator's passing was not just a personal one. He'd been a staunch supporter of the president's efforts on health care reform, and his seniority and moral authority was vital to any chance of bringing both parties in the Senate together. We often wondered if, had he lived, his Republican colleagues would have behaved any better. His death also dealt another terrible strategic blow to the campaign. Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, having swept in on a big wave on the president's coattails. We had a 257-vote majority in the House. We also had a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, meaning we had just enough votes to overcome a Republican filibuster. Because Massachusetts had a Democratic governor, Deval Patrick, we could be assured that he would appoint a Democrat to fill Kennedy's seat temporarily, but a special election would soon follow, putting our supermajority at risk. Plus, health care reform was bottlenecking the rest of our legislative agenda, and we knew the closer we came to the midterm elections, the harder it would be to pass anything. We had to move fast, and we set the end of the year as an ambitious goal to finish up. And so, all through the fall, we never let up. My team planned events with people who would benefit from our proposed reforms, such as moms with sick children and people who might go into bankruptcy trying to pay health care bills. Speaker Pelosi whipped the votes in the House, while Leader Reid fought to hold the Democratic caucus together in the Senate. We could afford to lose a few Democratic votes in the House, but in the Senate, we need every last one. And we mustered the votes. In November, the House passed its version of the health care bill, H.R. 3962, with 219 Democratic votes and one Republican vote, with 39 Democrats and 176 Republicans voting against. 6 weeks later, on Christmas Eve, the Senate passed its version of the bill, called America's Healthy Future Act, with all 60 Democrats in favor, 39 Republicans against, and one Republican abstaining. We were so close. In any normal legislative process, the next step would have been for the leaders in both houses to create a joint conference committee to iron out the differences between the two bills, formulating a compromise bill acceptable to the majorities in both chambers. But before that could happen, in January, Republican Scott Brown won the special election to fill Ted Kennedy's seat, having made it explicitly clear during his campaign that he was opposed to the president's health care plan. Our supermajority was lost. Now, even if Congress produced a unified health care bill, there was no way for it to get past the Republican filibuster. And if no new legislation could pass the Senate, that meant the House was stuck with the Senate version of the bill, which many House Democrats found unacceptable. The more liberal Democrats wanted the public option, and the conservative Democrats thought it was too liberal. Welcome to Washington. We were stuck. What could possibly be the third way now? With Republican support completely off the table, our only hope for passing the bill lay in cajoling and convincing the hesitant House Democrats to come down off the fence and vote for the Senate version of the bill. This battle had to proceed on two fronts. First, Speaker Pelosi and the White House had to do some serious political horse trading with undecided members to bring them on board. Second, we had to keep up the engagement of members' constituents. Contrary to popular belief, representative democracy actually can work, and a broad network of supporters sent a flood of letters and phone calls demanding action. And since Republicans were keeping the phone lines jammed with bogus claims of death panels and government takeover, thankfully our supporters were out there calling and writing their members of Congress as well. Our fortunes began to change when we were given a gift from the political gods. In early February, the health insurance company Anthem Blue Cross announced to its customers that they were going to see rate increases of 30% to 39% that year. It couldn't have been a more timely or more perfect reminder of what was wrong with the healthcare system and why we were fighting to reform it. President Obama was able to drive home the anthem story during a pre-Super Bowl interview with Katie Couric, one of the biggest media platforms of the year. Then, in late February, the president hosted a bipartisan meeting with Republicans and Democrats to discuss how to move healthcare forward. Many Democrats felt it would be a huge waste of time since Republicans had refused to come to the table, but in the end, it was a brilliant bit of political theater on the president's part. It showed him as reasonable by reaching out to the other side after Scott Brown's victory. It also allowed us to force the Republicans to put their healthcare ideas out on the table, at which point it became clear that they didn't have any. They weren't obstructing our solution so they could implement their solution. They were just blocking our reforms that would help the American people. We were finally back in control of the story, and then we found the perfect voice to help bring victory home. One way President Obama enjoyed staying connected with everyday people, who we called real people, was to read 10 of their letters every evening, a representative sample of that day's mail. The letters were from people from all 50 states, all walks of life, and all political parties. The correspondence department, tasked with reading all thousands of letters that poured into the White House each day, had a staff of readers, and part of each reader's job was to recommend a letter from his or her batch to be one of the 10 letters that were sent up to the president. The highlight of the reader's day was if the head of the unit chose his or her letter. The president often responded to the sender with a note, sometimes handwritten. The letters, circulated to senior staff as well, were an important source of feedback directly from the American people. They often reminded me of the stories I heard in the mayor's office in Chicago when I was deputy chief of staff. From time to time, I would contact the senders to let them know that their letter had moved me, and also to add a human voice to any formal response they might receive. I always asked them, "What time of day did you write the letter?" And their answer was almost always late at night, when the kids were asleep, work was done, and the house was quiet. I told them their stories were important, and I thanked them for taking the time to write. During the healthcare debate, a moving letter found its way to the president's desk. It was from Natoma Canfield, a wonderfully warm and humble woman who wrote about how her insurance costs were skyrocketing due to a divorce, self-employment, and her pre-existing condition, which was a 16-year-old cancer diagnosis that had been in remission for over a decade. She could no longer afford to keep up with her premiums. "I live in the house my mother and father built in 1958, and I am so afraid of the possibility I might lose this family heirloom as a result of my being forced to drop my health insurance," she wrote. "Please stay focused in your reform attempts, as I and many others are in desperate need of your help." After one of my staffers, Ann Widger from the Office of Public Engagement, tracked down the Medina, Ohio letter writer, the president chose her story to help tell the bigger story of why America needed the Affordable Care Act. He knew her gut-wrenching experience could help people understand the importance of the legislation because everyone could imagine themselves or somebody they loved in Natoma's predicament. The president read Natoma's letter out loud in a meeting with the insurance executives to personalize the devastating impact of our current system, and we then released the letter to the press. He even framed her letter and hung it in the Oval Office as a daily reminder of why he was fighting so hard. It was a closing argument for which the other side had no rebuttal. The president then invited Natoma to introduce him at a rally in Ohio to make the final push for Congress to pass health care reform legislation. But Natoma couldn't make it. What we didn't know is that she'd collapsed a week before the event and had been diagnosed with leukemia. Her sister, Connie Anderson, appeared in her place, telling the crowd that Natoma, who had dropped her insurance earlier that year because of the unaffordable rate hikes, was now lying in a hospital bed with cancer, terrified about how she would pay the bill. "So you want to know why I'm here, Ohio?" President Obama said. "I'm here because of Natoma." Natoma used her soft voice to tell the most powerful man in the world her story. President Obama amplified Natoma's voice, and the Affordable Care Act received a shot in the arm. Just an ordinary person who made an extraordinary difference. With less than a week to go before the vote, dozens of Democratic lawmakers were still wavering. But by then, we found our third way. Budget reconciliation, a parliamentary procedure that allows certain budget-related laws to pass with only 51% of the votes. The House would vote to approve the Senate version of the bill, and then the differences would be ironed out in reconciliation. It wasn't an elegant solution, but it would work. Speaker Pelosi had the votes. On March 21, 2010, the night Congress was set for the final vote on the Affordable Care Act, Susan Scheer and I decided to go home to watch it on television. I had everything set up, big TV, couch, popcorn, wine. But just as we plopped down on the couch in our pajamas, the phone rang. It was the president's assistant, Katie Johnson. "Valerie, the president would like you to come back to the White House to watch the vote," she said. "Susan, too." "Katie, we're in our PJs with a bowl of popcorn on our laps. We're good." "Valerie, President Obama would like everyone who worked on the Affordable Care Act to come to the White House." So back to the White House we trudged, dressed, just in time to catch the tail end of the vote from the Roosevelt Room, where everyone was gathered. The president, beaming when the Affordable Care Act passed, impulsively said, "Come on upstairs, everyone. Let's celebrate." And the crowd all cheered. Because most of the White House was like a museum, with its occupants often on display for the public, the Obamas kept the executive residence very private. Few of the staff had been upstairs, so everyone was very excited by the spontaneous invitation. Champagne and appetizers appeared out of nowhere. I could only imagine the scurrying around that went on in the kitchen when news that nearly 100 people were on their way upstairs hit the household staff. But for the guests, it was a terrific party. And that night, our famously calm and cool president was positively bubbly. He was so grateful to his team, and he showed it. When I introduced him to Ann Widger, the staffer who'd found Natoma Canfield and nurtured the relationship, giving Natoma and her sister the courage to use their voices, the president put both hands on her shoulders and said, "Thank you so much. It's because of your hard work that Natoma became our symbol, and we got this done." Ann had never spoken to the president before, and now he was beaming at her and giving her credit for the country's first successful health care reform bill. She was mesmerized. We stayed outside on the Truman balcony into the wee hours of the morning. After the crowd started to thin out, I walked over to the president as he was expressing his gratitude to Nancy Ann. More than anyone else, he knew she was the unsung hero responsible for the bill's passage. The president was so effusive with Nancy Ann that she began to look a little uncomfortable. When Nancy Ann extricated herself from our emotional commander-in-chief, I sidled over to him. The Truman balcony, with its view spanning the South Lawn, is by far my favorite place in the White House. In the spring of our first year, the Obamas discovered what became their favorite spot, too. The majestic view of the South Lawn, with the monuments in the distance, brought me the same sense of peace that Lake Michigan did back home in Chicago. The Obamas hung out there as often as possible when the weather permitted. There, we all felt we could smell the fresh air, catch our breath, and exhale. As we leaned over the edge of the balcony that first night of spring, on an unseasonably warm evening, it reminded me of election night in Chicago. I looked up at the president. "You seem so happy," I said. "How do you feel tonight compared to election night?" "There's no comparison," he said, looking out at the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Memorial. "Election night was just the means necessary to make this night possible." Chapter 12. Where is my boom? "Turn on the television, Valerie. There's been an explosion in the Gulf." Strott nearly shouted as he ran into my office out of breath. He must have climbed the 2 flights from the entrance to the West Wing adjacent to his office next door in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. I could always tell when he didn't wait for the elevator, and that's when I learned that on April 20th, 2010, the Deepwater Horizon oil rig exploded in the Gulf of Mexico, killing 11 workers and creating the largest oil spill in our nation's history. It quickly spread through the Gulf waters of 5 neighboring states, Louisiana, Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, and Texas. Through my work in the Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, my team and I knew all of the nation's governors. We were their gateway to the administration. If they had a problem and the federal government could help, and often when we couldn't, they came to us. The day after the explosion, when it was clear there were no easy solutions, President Obama called me into the Oval Office and said, "Your job is to talk to those governors whose states are affected every single day until the oil spill is behind us. Not their staff, the governors and you. I want them to know any concerns they have are being communicated by you directly to me." Okay, I thought, no big deal. How long could this last? A few days, a week max? Every day, 7 days a week, for 3 months straight, I had a 9 a.m. phone call with the 5 governors, Louisiana's Bobby Jindal, Mississippi's Haley Barbour, Alabama's Bob Riley, Florida's Charlie Crist, and Texas's Rick Perry. It just so happened that the governors of the 5 affected states were all Republicans, but to us their political party was always irrelevant. Solving the massive environmental disaster with minimum damage to the states was our sole objective. Every morning, I'd start the call by saying, "How are we doing? What can we do?" I always use the word "we" so that they would understand I viewed us as being on the same team, working through the mounting challenges on the ground together. Many of the conversations revolved around BOOM, the floating physical barriers that corralled and contained oil on the water surface. Because Louisiana had the biggest part of the spill, Jindal received the lion's share of the BOOM, and the other governors always wanted to know, "Well, where's our BOOM?" I wish I had a transcript of some of those conversations, because they reveal a fundamental truth about politics and governing. Behind all the posturing on cable news, when people of different ideological backgrounds are faced with a crisis, they can, and often do, actually work and solve the problems, together. Their constituents were our constituents. Sometimes our commitment to goodwill across the aisle meant spending hours in line taking photos at state dinners or holiday parties with people who had publicly slammed the president that very same day, or smiling at Republicans who came to the White House for the congressional ball but refused to walk through the receiving line to greet the Obamas, their host and hostess. Governor Jindal once hung up the phone after asking for some assistance and went directly to a press conference within 60 seconds, criticizing us for not completing what he had asked. I was annoyed by his duplicity, but that is politics. The next day, I was back on the phone asking, "How could we help?" In my 24 years of public service, it has always been my practice to have an open door. If someone who disagrees with me or has a beef or a problem is willing to come in and talk, I go into the conversation confident we can find common ground. In part, it may have stemmed from those early days in Iran, learning to play happily with children of all backgrounds. Certainly when I worked for the city of Chicago, I interacted with a range of constituents from all over the city. Just because they were openly critical did not give me an excuse to ignore them. When I gave their tempers the space and the respect to subside, more often than not, we made progress. Public service does not mean you pick or choose to work only with your friends. Anyone could walk in at any time for any reason, and I would hear them out and try to help. As commissioner of the Department of Planning and Development, I had to work with stakeholders from a wide array of groups, groups that were very often working in strident opposition to one another or to us. Indeed, one of the most satisfying parts of public service to me was bringing those disparate groups together and discovering common ground. I brought the same attitude with me to D.C. I also recognize that, especially in Washington, without broad-based support, nothing can be accomplished. As President Obama has said, appealing only to your own base might be a worthwhile strategy for winning elections, but it does not allow you to govern. To govern, you need buy-in from as many people as possible so that everyone has a stake in the success of your policies and programs, which is why, in my West Wing roles, I had a responsibility to work with everyone and couldn't afford to close my door to anyone. Possibly the strangest of my strange bedfellow relationships was with Mark Holden, General Counsel of Koch Industries. No single entity worked harder to make sure that Barack Obama and every other Democrat at every level of government were not elected than the one led by the Koch brothers, whose names are synonymous with the libertarian conservative agenda. For decades, billionaires Charles and David Koch had funded federal, state, and local candidates who promoted their views, as well as soft money political organizations that have spent a fortune campaigning against every candidate they oppose. In early 2015, I heard Mark Holden had scheduled a meeting with Cecilia Munoz, by then promoted to be the head of the Domestic Policy Council, because he was interested in working with us on criminal justice reform. President Obama had given me responsibility for overseeing our criminal justice reform efforts in his second term in office. So when Cecilia told me about the scheduled meeting, I dropped by, mostly out of curiosity. Who was this guy who stepped voluntarily into what I assumed he viewed as enemy territory? Right at the start of the meeting, I asked Mark, "What are you doing in the Obama White House?" He smiled, and then, much to my surprise, he gave a really good answer. He said, for one of his first jobs, when he was 18 years old, he'd worked for a year in the Worcester House of Corrections in West Boylston, Massachusetts, and he'd seen firsthand the problems with incarceration in America. There were probably 15 people I knew growing up who were locked up in there, he said. I was arrested once for underage drinking, but the case was dropped, and I was lucky I didn't get arrested for anything else, and lucky I had parents who rode me hard. My former classmates weren't so lucky. They didn't have any real support systems or resources and ended up incarcerated. It was a there but for the grace of God go I experience, and it sticks with me to this day. One person who also moved me deeply, who I called, was a federal judge. He had written President Obama a letter that told the story of a young man he had sentenced to life in prison 20 years earlier under mandatory sentencing guidelines. While the judge believed the man should have received a reduced sentence and a second chance, his hands were tied by the mandatory sentencing law. The injustice of it haunted the judge for 20 years. Frustrated by Congress's inaction, President Obama had stepped up his effort to commute the sentences of nonviolent drug offenders, who are often the victims of these harsh and inhumane mandatory sentencing laws. By the fall of 2016, he had commuted more sentences than the prior 11 presidents combined. Because I was responsible for criminal justice reform, a staffer in the correspondence office sent me the letter from the judge. Every time we published the list, the people whose sentences President Obama had commuted, the judge wrote, he combed the list, hoping to find this man's name. Finally, it appeared on the list, and the judge felt inspired to write President Obama, expressing his gratitude for the peace of mind he now had that would allow him to enjoy a good night's sleep. Over the 18 months that Mark and I worked closely on criminal justice reform together, we often joked that our conversations were very limited in scope. We were aware that there were plenty of topics where we weren't likely to agree, but we never let that get in the way of making progress where we could. Once, after yet another mass shooting, I asked Mark if he thought we should pass a law to help keep guns out of the wrong hands. "I don't own a gun," he responded. After a short pause, we realized that was as far down the path as we were going to be able to go, and we went back to criminal justice reform. We eventually garnered about 80 votes in the Senate in support of a bipartisan bill to reduce mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders. Although, thanks to Leader McConnell, who refused to have the bill called up for a vote in the Judiciary Committee, it didn't pass before President Obama left office, the progress we did make would not have been possible without Mark. And since the end of the Obama administration, Mark and I continue to collaborate on criminal justice reform. We coincidentally bumped into each other on the street, near where we both live in D.C., on the eve of the passage for the First Step Act in December of 2018. We both acknowledged that it should have passed sooner, but were grateful that Congress finally decided to act. My team and I were also regularly in touch with members of the evangelical community who, by and large, didn't support President Obama, but who were firmly committed to criminal justice reform and immigration reform because of their belief in forgiveness and family unification. In addition to keeping channels open to work with anyone who was willing, we also brought those divergent views together in hopes of using our good offices to help them find common ground. When President Obama was deciding whether to sign an executive order banning workplace discrimination against LGBTQ employees of the federal government and federal contractors after Congress failed to pass legislation covering all employers, advocates for the LGBTQ and faith communities had strong opinions, not just about the issue, but also about each other. Before making a recommendation to the president, my team and I heard out all the groups for and against it, from organizations such as Focus on the Family and religious leaders to the Human Rights Campaign and the Center for American Progress. When they were alone with me, the faith community leaders were often uncompromising and even strident in their attitudes. Finally, after my team had had dozens of separate meetings with no progress, I thought, why am I playing shuttle diplomacy here? So I invited leaders whom I trusted from both sides of the issue, the ones I knew would be both candid and respectful, to sit across the table and talk to each other directly. The tenor of the conversation was completely different when they had to face each other, as opposed to speaking behind each other's backs. By the time the president decided to move forward with the executive order, I like to think that the reason we didn't get a lot of pushback on it from the faith community was because they'd had a chance to both listen and speak to their LGBTQ brothers and sisters in a safe place. In the course of bringing all these groups together across a variety of issues, my team and I absorbed a great deal of pain. But it was usually worth it. My outreach to Mark Holden, Rupert Murdoch, Jim Daly, and evangelicals and other conservative groups was founded in the belief that where there is common ground, there doesn't need to be unanimity. There were those in the progressive community who questioned why we reached out to the enemy, but we fundamentally didn't see it that way. Just because we disagreed with someone on 99 issues never prevented us from working together on the 100th. And my willingness to join forces with partners of all stripes was not unique at the White House. This approach started at the top. The president mandated that his team have open lines of dialogue with everyone who wanted to engage. He invited members of Congress, the same ones who'd said horrendous things about him, to meetings, state dinners, private dinners, and holiday parties in the hopes of breaking down the barriers in the way of finding common ground. He also had countless meetings, large and small, with business leaders who disagreed with him on a range of policy issues, as well as with our supporters who disagreed with us, including progressives who were concerned that he was not forward-leaning enough on closing Guantanamo Bay and torture, with the immigration advocates who were demanding faster action on reforms, and with the LGBTQ advocates unhappy about our progress on repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Before making a significant decision, he would want to hear how it would directly impact those affected. In terms of bringing disparate groups together to create meaningful change, one of our greatest successes was the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the ban on gay people serving openly in the military. Together with Democratic leadership in Congress, the White House started working on the repeal of the law from day one, another campaign promise and a top priority. While we had the votes to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the House, we had to overcome a Republican filibuster in the Senate being led by John McCain. President Obama knew that the key to repeal was to get the military to buy in. To head up my office's LGBTQ efforts, I recruited Brian Bond, a deeply committed LGBTQ advocate who grew up in the conservative 50,000-person city of Joplin, Missouri. Brian was both gay and, since 2001, HIV positive. Passionate about his work, he was highly respected by his colleagues. Brian had deep roots and relationships in the LGBTQ community, and he caught a lot of heat for what many advocates thought was foot-dragging by the Obama administration. They wanted President Obama to unilaterally direct the military not to discharge service members who were openly gay. We agreed that the law was morally wrong, but it was the law. We also had a strong preference, wherever feasible, to seek congressional action, since executive orders can be repealed at the will of any future president, as we have seen President Obama's successor do. Bringing the military to the table to solicit their support was going to take time, but the advocates burning up Brian's phone line wanted action now, and understandably so. When Don't Ask, Don't Tell was originally passed into law in 1993, I didn't know any gay service members personally. I remember thinking it was bizarrely hypocritical, to say the least, for a law to require service members who take an oath to uphold the Constitution to lie. But it wasn't until Brian brought several service members into the White House to meet with me in early 2010 that the full impact of the law's injustice hit home. Fearing being outed, they'd come to the meeting out of uniform. These were men and women who dedicated their lives to serving this country, and yet they couldn't even come to the White House openly and honestly. One of the service members was a woman named Major Casey Mose, who oversaw ethics training at West Point, and she talked about the ethics of teaching ethics while living a lie. She said, "I shouldn't have to trade my values for my service." She told me about her partner, who had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and not being able to share her grief with her colleagues at work. How she felt disrespectful as well as dishonest to never be able to acknowledge her relationship. Another described how she was deprived of the simple acts, such as displaying her partner's photos on her desk or bringing her to work functions. It was painful for the service members to open up and share their stories, but they touched me profoundly and gave me a new sense of urgency to get the law repealed. Although LGBTQ advocates put a lot of pressure on us, President Obama refused to move the bill forward until we tried to go through the process recommended by the military leadership. If the Secretary of Defense, Joint Chiefs, and rank and file were not on board, we knew a favorable vote in Congress would be impossible. Through the summer and fall of 2010, the military was taking months to survey its membership and analyze how lifting the ban would be implemented. Meanwhile, tempers in the advocacy community were hitting a flashpoint, and poor Brian was the tip of the spear. Before he scheduled yet another meeting to ask them to keep waiting, he pleaded with me, "I need your help. I can't go back to these groups one more time. Can you assure them that we are committed?" Periodically, my staff would bring advocates in to meet with me to improve my understanding of the issues and demonstrate to the advocates that their issue was a priority, particularly when we had no actual progress to show them. On the day the meeting was scheduled, it happened that I was in the Roosevelt Room with President Obama on another matter just beforehand. As I started to leave, the president asked what I was doing next. "I'm on my way to get beat up by our LGBTQ friends because we haven't repealed Don't Ask, Don't Tell yet," I said. "They're giving you a hard time, huh?" "They're giving Brian a hard time. I'm just trying to absorb some of his pain. Bring them over and I'll talk to them." "Yes." Quickly, before some other crisis absorbed him, I brought the group over to the Roosevelt Room. They didn't shy away from voicing their frustration. "Mr. President," they said, "it's taking too long. Every day, good people are being discharged." "Hear me," he said, measuring his words carefully. "I know the way to do this, and we will get there." We could all feel the president's sincerity and conviction. They took a deep breath, and although they kept the pressure on us, they also directed their frustration towards Congress. and it worked. In late November, the Department of Defense issued the results of an exhaustive survey which concluded that repealing the law would have little or no impact on combat readiness, and that 70% of the service members believed the impact would be positive. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Joint Chiefs Chairman Admiral Michael Mullen both testified before the Senate, calling for a swift repeal. Admiral Mullen's heartfelt testimony sent shockwaves through the Republican members of Congress. He said, "No matter how I look at the issue, I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens. For me, personally, it comes down to integrity. Theirs as individuals and ours as an institution." Within the next 3 weeks, repeal passed in the House in a vote of 250 to 175 and passed in the Senate in a vote of 65 to 31, even picking up a few Republican votes in both houses, in large part because we'd brought the military on board. It was the only time I went up to the Senate to watch a vote. I knew it would be historic. On December 22, 2010, President Obama signed the repeal into law, 17 years after Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted. All the activists who'd been yelling at us behind closed doors and criticizing us in the press showed up like dear old friends to hug us and cry tears of joy. At the signing ceremony, Brian sat me, with a touch of irony, next to a man I'd seen just days before the bill passed, lambasting President Obama on TV. But all was forgiven, because I knew he had just been doing his job. The pressure and the pain led to a better result. President Obama had been willing to take the heat, holding out to achieve sustainable change. Bringing the military into the process slowed it down, but ultimately led to the passage of the bill, and even more importantly, broader-based acceptance of openly gay men and women in the military. The repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell was a triumph and an example of how governing should work. It was a validation of my core beliefs, stemming from the lessons I'd learned in my early days in city government in Chicago about how to build public bipartisan support from the ground up, especially in a cause as clear and as right as we knew this one to be. Those lessons held true. Until they didn't. President Obama has a gesture he uses from time to time, and when he does, he's close to a breakthrough. He holds his hand up and twists his fingers like he's opening a combination lock or safe. "We just need to figure out how to unlock this," he'll say, twirling the invisible dial in front of him. It's a metaphor he uses whenever he's trying to figure out a problem. Every safe has a combination. You just have to be patient enough to figure it out. A devout believer in reason and the power of communication, Barack Obama believes that there's a rational solution to be found to just about any challenge. And why wouldn't he? From the editor of the Harvard Law Review to winner of the Iowa caucuses to the presidency, his entire rise has been based on his ability to reach people, find what motivates them, touch their hearts as well as their minds, and bring them together on common ground. But then he encountered a safe that had no combination, that couldn't be opened by any amount of patience, cajoling, logic, or reason, or by sledgehammers or blowtorches for that matter. From the day he entered office, congressional Republicans refused to work with us, period. Nonetheless, we continue to treat elected officials from both sides of the political aisle with respect. For the 2 years we enjoyed Democratic majorities in both houses and Congress, we did our best to still bring the other side to the table. We managed to wrangle a few Republican votes here and there, such as the handful who voted to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But for all of our efforts, we made very little progress persuading the Republicans in Congress to work with us. We spent precious months deferring to Senator Baucus while he tried hopelessly to secure Republican support for the Affordable Care Act. Over 200 amendments were made in the hope that at least Senator Olympia Snowe would break rank with her Republican colleagues. We kept hoping the Republicans were reachable. Their strategy outrageous, I think, was just to say no. The Republican leaders in Congress made no secret of their imperviousness to logic and compromise. For 2 years, then-Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell used his encyclopedic knowledge of Senate procedures to turn obstructionism into an art. McConnell famously said the night of the 2009 inauguration, "The single most important thing we want to achieve is for President Obama to be a one-term president. It interfered with the business of governing and was a great disservice to the American people, but we had enough votes to keep moving forward." Why, you might ask? Race, power, control, possibly all of the above. After the 2010 midterm election, House Minority Leader John Boehner went even further, vowing not just to stop President Obama's actions in the future, but to go back and undo the past. On a conservative radio show, he vowed to dismantle all the reforms the Affordable Care Act had set in motion. "We're going to do everything, and I mean everything we can do, to kill it, stop it, slow it down, whatever we can." And he wasn't talking only about the Affordable Care Act. He was talking about how they wanted to run the country. Having successfully wound up the Tea Party and even some less extreme conservative citizens through inflated fears of death panels and socialist government takeover, the Republican Party gained 63 seats, recapturing the majority, taking the speakership away from Nancy Pelosi and giving it to John Boehner. In the Senate, Republicans gained 6 seats, leaving us with a slim 51-seat majority. "We got shellacked," President Obama said. Still, ever the optimist, he proclaimed that now the fever will break. By fever, he meant the Republicans' fevered efforts to oppose him on everything his administration was trying to do, even the kinds of proposals that traditionally enjoyed bipartisan support, such as for infrastructure investment. Now that Republicans were responsible for leadership of the House, the president thought they would be motivated to work with him. They couldn't just block our agenda, they had to create one. That did not happen. We tried every possible approach: private dinners at the White House, public dinners at restaurants, President Obama's treat, invitations to play golf with the president and attend state dinners, private phone calls, televised meetings, including one where President Obama engaged in a spirited back and forth with just the Republican caucus. Nothing worked. They said no to cap and trade to reform our national energy policy, no to infrastructure investment and other ways to create jobs and strengthen our economy. By the time President Obama left office, the Republicans in the House had voted over 50 times to repeal ACA, knowing their bill would fail in the Senate. What an incredible waste of time. Just imagine what good we could have accomplished during all those hours wasted on their symbolic bill going nowhere. After the 2010 midterms, life in Washington was a lot like the final dismal months of my marriage. The legislative branch sitting alone in its man cave, drinking wine with headphones on, and the executive branch leaning on the door in sexy lingerie, waiting for them to come upstairs and govern the country with us. And they never would. They simply weren't interested. Barack Obama had fundamental assumptions about how the federal government should work, assumptions that in retrospect seem no longer true. We believed that the viability of our democracy depends on government functioning, which requires listening to one another and, yes, compromise. Because if we believe in democracy, then there is no exit from this union. We are in this together, and either we find a way to work together or the system breaks down and people, millions of people, are seriously hurt. In the first term, we hit rock bottom with the debt ceiling debacle in the summer of 2011. When some members of the Tea Party caucus argued publicly that it would be good for the country if we defaulted on the full faith and credit of the U.S. government for the first time in its history. The government had until August 2nd to vote to raise the debt ceiling in order to allow the Treasury to pay its bills, expenditures already approved by Congress, which was typically done with minimal debate. Now, the Tea Party caucus believed that we, the Democrats, were spending too much money, and they wanted to teach us a lesson by forcing us to not pay our bills, including debt on Treasury bonds, despite the fact that U.S. Treasury bonds are what stabilizes the world economy. To default on them would send shockwaves through international financial markets. The Tea Party's obliviousness to the very real and potentially irreparable damage they would do to the world economy was simply astounding. While at Camp David that July, several friends and I were sitting out by the pool when the president disappeared. I went looking for him and overheard him on the phone talking with Speaker Boehner. "John," the president said, "if we stand together and you raise taxes on the wealthy and I support entitlement reform, the grand bargain, the country will follow our lead." It was an audacious compromise for the greater good, but Speaker Boehner could not be cajoled or convinced. He knew if he went along with raising taxes, he would lose his speakership. As the August 2nd deadline neared, the president's financial, political, and legislative advisors worked around the clock to try to come up with a budget proposal that would be acceptable to the Republicans, but all we heard back was no. Eric Whitaker, Marty Nesbitt, and I had made a pact during one of our many discussions in Marty's man cave in Chicago before I left for Washington. If I ever really needed them, they would drop whatever they were doing and come to Washington. It was a Friday before the vote, and I decided this was one of those times. The weekend could trigger an historic catastrophe, and with Michelle out of town, I thought we needed moral support, particularly from someone who wasn't knee-deep in the mess. Since Marty's younger daughter was still a baby, I decided to spare him and to stay on his wife Anita's good side, and so I called on Eric. Eric had a presence I found soothing. I thought he could lighten the mood, just as he and Marty had done in Indiana during the dark days of the presidential campaign, when they'd made us laugh by doing their version of Reverend Wright's chicken dance. I rang him up and said in no uncertain terms, "You need to come to town. I need you here." And, good friend that he is, he came right away. The president, Eric, and I spent the long summer evening on the Truman balcony, punctuated by the trips President Obama kept making down to the West Wing to check on the negotiations' progress, or lack thereof. Finally, late in the night, after his umpteenth trip downstairs, the president, uncharacteristically agitated, said, "I better find out what happens to me if I direct my treasury to pay the bills without congressional authority, because it doesn't look like they're the least bit interested in working this out." We called his personal lawyer, Bob Bauer, who had previously been White House counsel, to talk it through. Bob didn't need long to lay it out for us. "The answer is simple," he said. "He'll be impeached, and he'll have to hire his own lawyer and pay some part of the legal fees for acting outside the scope of his authority." Oh, my. 2 days later, just hours before the August 2nd deadline, Speaker Boehner blinked. An agreement was reached to avoid default, but it wasn't the historic deal that it could have been. It had all been political theater, with a final encore by the speaker, who called the president at the 11th hour trying to tack on one last stipulation, defunding a Planned Parenthood. "No, John," the president said, "we're not doing that." Boehner was so worried about holding on to his speakership that he ceded the authority of his position to a rogue minority faction. But what is the purpose of occupying a leadership position if you refuse to lead? If Boehner had made the grand bargain that President Obama implored him to do, yes, he might have lost his speakership. But he would have gone down in history as having successfully tackled a long-term fiscal challenge, in much the same way President George H.W. Bush did when he increased taxes to reduce the deficit in the 1990 budget. Bush lost re-election, but is remembered as a principal leader because he did what he thought best served the country, regardless of the personal consequences to him. The irony, of course, is that Speaker Boehner resigned and lost his speakership anyway, and who even remembers why? From day one, the Republicans were determined to thwart all of our attempts to work constructively across the aisle and address the very real challenges that our country faced. In the spirit of our program, for 2.5 years, whenever I spoke publicly, even in our private meetings, I always dug deep to project optimism, even though I thought their behavior was reckless and irresponsible. But that summer, I was incapable of containing my rage. A couple of days after the deadline, we were back at Camp David to celebrate the president's birthday. A group of about 20 friends were hanging out late into the night in the Hickory Lodge game room. I had been gloomy all day.